Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Justin Graybaugh. We'll be taking a look at the agenda for tomorrow's meeting. Also, the CEO of Holy Cross Ministries, Emmy Gardner, will be joining us in studio. We'll be talking with Sister Norma Pimentel, the Executive Director of the Catholic Charities of the Rio Grande Valley, and a special guest speaker at the upcoming annual Fall Harvest Festival. And finally, the Director of Utah Open Lands, Wendy Fisher, telling us a little bit about a new Northfields initiative, as well as details on their upcoming fundraiser. Then stay tuned for This Green Earth. Today's guests include the founder and CEO of Weather 360, Bill Kirk, talking about what extreme weather events are on the way and how we can prepare for them as we enter the peak of the 2024 hurricane and wildfire seasons. Weather Trends 360 says that wildfire damage is expected to reach $20 billion. That's the worst in 4 years. Also predicting an intense hurricane season from now to early November. All of that coming up on This Green Earth. And of course, you can hear This Green Earth every Tuesday from 9 to 10. Taking a look at some local news now. State transportation officials will not sink State Route 224 below Kimball Junction to ease traffic woes, but county officials are brainstorming now on other ways to improve the gateway to Park City. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on that.
It's official, an underpass is out of the running in the race to fix Kimball Junction's traffic problem. And underpass was the Utah Department of Transportation's so-called Alternative B. Losing it is a disappointment to county transportation officials like Carl Miller, who tried to resuscitate the idea with a modified Alternative B+.
We were hoping with the fly under Alternative B, we would have, you know, a capped parking or a park on top of 224 as a plaza to really bridge the two neighborhoods together. Unfortunately, with that being screened out by UDOT, that's not really a possibility anymore.
Both B and B plus would have required relocating businesses and been more environmentally invasive, two reasons UDOT eliminated them. The remaining alternatives are A and C. A would add an extra interstate exit for Landmark Drive, but the Summit County Council favors C.
All the turns become two lanes, so every left turn is like two lanes going, and then it expands the lanes in around the highway interchange part. So basically what it's doing is just making the turn movements faster and more efficient, which allows the traffic to flow through faster.
That's council member Canis Hart. A wasn't the council's favorite because it would put more vehicles onto Landmark Drive into the path of pedestrians. And council members still like the idea of a grade-separated crossing, so they're adding a pedestrian bridge or other east-west connection to the public-private partnership discussion with Dakota Pacific Real Estate. Hart says a pedestrian bridge across the highway could create brand power as a gateway to the area. UDOT isn't proposing such a bridge because it takes longer to move people than a new tunnel would. But to the county, creating a space to sit and stay a while is the whole point. Miller and County Engineer Brandon Brady showed council members examples of similar gathering spaces from Austin, Texas to as far away as Turkey, August 28th. Miller pointed to one such example from Coimbra, Portugal.
This is simply changing the railing and beautifying that, and it adds a whole different element to it where people want to be there rather than get through it as fast as possible.
It's up to UDOT which alternative A or C is implemented. It could choose one later this year or in early 2025. Summit County would be on the hook for so-called betterments, including pedestrian footbridges and the like, but it has a potential development partner in Dakota Pacific. County officials have been discussing partnering with the Salt Lake City-based developer on redesigning the adjacent Kimball Junction Transit Center. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Wasatch County Council meets tomorrow starting at 4 o'clock. And on the phone with a preview, Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Leslie.
First up, the Board of Equalization adjustments and recommendations for approval. And I know the deadline to file an appeal is coming up September 15th. Any idea what kind of numbers you're seeing in this year in terms of disputed valuation?
This new year, we are seeing significantly fewer appeals compared to the previous 2 years.
All right. Last meeting, you had heard that more than 100 property owners asked to be adjusted from secondary property owners to primary status. Any idea why this is happening? I mean, are the second homeowners selling to primary residents, or are they just deciding to settle in the Heber Valley?
You know, usually what it is I believe Wasatch County, Summit County, and Washington County are three counties in the state of Utah that when you purchase a new home, it actually defaults to a secondary status, and then the owners have to come in and proactively apply to become a primary residence. Usually that's the case, and people don't notice until they get their tax notices that they're paying 100% of the property taxes when they just move into a home and they qualify for that primary residential exemption, which is a 45% decrease. So that's typically what's happened around this time of year, is anyone who's moved into a new home is coming to apply to kind of correct the record to make sure that they get that primary residential exemption.
Okay. But there's no no support if they had done it a year ago. I mean, it's, and the tax is paid. It's year by year, huh?
Yeah, typically, unless we have those applications in hand, we don't know what the status of those properties are, which is part of why we default the way that we do, because around half of our properties are secondary. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to go back and recreate what would have happened in the past, and ultimately it's on the taxpayer's responsibility to make sure that they're applying it. And we try to be as transparent and informative about this. It's part of why it's so important for people to pay attention to those tax notices that come out in the July timeframe. Because if there is an issue with your taxes, you have until the 15th of this month. So that's, you know, only 12 days away to be able to apply to get those things fixed.
Okay. Wasatch County Council will also hear about some updates for changes to employee leave, salaries, and benefits. Can you kind of give us an idea of what changes you hope to make?
Yeah, a lot of these are, kind of mundane. We adopted a leave policy last year, and we're making just a few tweaks to it. They're kind of more procedural things dealing with how we handle FMLA and other things like that. And then the employee salaries and benefits. Last year, Wasatch County adopted a new wage study that has previously the county didn't have a very rigid grade and step model, which is kind of bands that people are compensated in, the steps within those bands. What this policy does is it kind of outlines and increases the transparency of how people advance within those bands, and if someone's getting promotions or changes or things like that. So this policy just handles and formalizes all of the things that we kind of started last year. And now this helps us make sure that all of the employees and citizens are aware of what we're doing when it comes to our compensation internally.
Okay. Let's see. The council is also set to do a site visit to Sky Ridge tomorrow. To do what exactly?
So we've talked about for, it's been a while now, that Sky Ridge is working with MIDA to build a new golf academy lodge. So they have a golf academy with a public facility that people can golf at, that's under construction right now. This would be a hotel that they're looking to build that MIDA has a partnership in. The combination there is that it's both a recreational facility for the public, that people will be able to rent rooms, but MIDA will also have two rooms, I believe, that will be reservable for military members. And they're aiming primarily at hosting families and people who have disabilities in partnership with some recovery efforts for veterans.
Okay, any idea how big the hotel is? I mean, two rooms out of how many?
I think it's about a 40-room hotel, so it's not a very large one. And some of the things that we've been looking at that I believe KBCW has reported on in the past are how we're handling parking on and off site of it, and how the unique topography of the site, they're requesting some variances from the height code. One of the reasons why we're talking about doing it this way is that there are zones within the Jordan L Basin Overlay Zone that would allow them to build this type of structure. But rather than rezone any of that area and potentially open it to even higher intensity uses, we feel like the route that we're going, which is a development agreement, would allow us to be able to offer the fewest exemptions to this code while facilitating this priority project for MIDA.
All right. Speaking of MIDA, and I've been doing a little bit of digging. I'm trying to just find somewhere on the website or out there on the internet, where do I go to find out about all of the MIDA and new development happening there on the what was originally the Mayflower property? You know, part of it's now Deer Valley, you know, East Village. We also, of course, have that marina parcel on the other side of the highway closer to the Jordan L. But where is all of that?
So MIDA, I mean, it's a little bit of complicated because originally everything was under the county's land use authority. So the county has a lot of information for things prior to you know, kind of the 20-teens. But MIDA itself, they have a website. It's midaut.org, so midaut.org. And on there, you can find a lot of access to the meetings that they have. MIDA is actually a much larger organization than just Wasatch County. They have Hill Air Force Base and other statewide programs that they're involved in. There is the Utah Public Notice website as well as a great resource for anyone interested in MIDA or any other public entity. You can subscribe to get notifications when those entities have meetings. Best places to go to pay attention to what's happening there is we have a public DRC meeting, of which I'm a member, and they review as projects come in what the requests are and what's changing there. And then the MIDA board also has meetings, usually a few times a year, where they're making higher level approvals for the project. But going back into the past, some of the best ways to do that are if it's prior to the 20-teen era, then the county's own website is the best source there. And then the Utah Public Notice websites and others are kind of the other best places. Often there are recorded documents against those property that outline what the site plan approvals are or what the plats are and things like that.
Yeah, what I guess I'm really looking for is some kind of master plan. I mean, is there one for the entire area there, or is all of this development been done piecemeal?
So there is an overall concept plan that was included in the original approval that I believe the county granted to the developers there. And what has kind of gone on since then is as they have made changes, those changes have been pieces of that overall master plan. I think generally the concept has been very consistent from the time when it was under county land use through into MIDA. And what has really changed is some of the details about where the exact placement of buildings are, which buildings are which, and, you know, massing shifting between some, you know, from one building to another.
Yeah, so is there a way that Wasatch County can kind of link this on its website? Again, I mean, I searched, you know, Deer Valley East Village, MIDA, Mayflower Mountain Resort on the Wasatch County website and came up with absolutely zero.
Yeah, well, so because most of those final approvals have gone through a different land use authority. The county has not, you know, really done anything outside of what we would typically do for, say, Heber City or Midway City if they were doing a major project. What we do, though, is we also have a MIDA coordinator. In my office, his name's Richard Brighton Beaker, has provided some updates to the council. And I believe one earlier this year did a pretty good job of a high level overview of what the major projects were and what the timelines were associated with that. I'd have to look up the specifics of what that meeting was, but I think that's a really great resource as well that we have recorded on our website. We have the presentation that he gave up there and he kind of walks through it and I think did a really great job kind of summarizing at a high level what's going on in that project area.
Okay, well, if you do find that, I'd love to know about it. Thank you.
No problem.
Any progress on the affordable housing for the used to be called the Marina Parcel? I don't know if that's still how it's being identified.
Yeah, so there is, I believe that's the Marina West Parcel. And we have had some progress there in that I believe Extel is working through the development approval, kind of master planning what that portion looked like. There was a concept plan when the county worked with MIDA on facilitating the current property ownership structure, but I believe that they're still working through the details of what that will look like, and it's probably a couple years out. I think what we're hoping for and what they're hoping for as well is making sure that those affordable units are online when we see kind of the bigger bang of when more projects are completed up there. So that's probably somewhere in like the two plus year range out.
All right. I've seen the written response from the Midway City Council over the proposed letter that Midway, Wasatch County, Heber City, and Wasatch County Board of Education were going to send to UDOT about the bypass road. Now Midway leaders are essentially saying they have no confidence that the remaining UDOT alternatives for the bypass meet their strategic outcomes and will not provide the traffic relief that everyone's trying to solve. It only relocates the traffic. So what's your reaction to Midway's response?
When we first talked about this letter, it was at our interlocal meeting, and there was, I think, high-level consensus that the Heber Valley wants a bypass to help address traffic and transportation issues within the Heber Valley. What there was not a lot of consensus on, at least immediately, was the best way to send that message to UDOT. Wasatch County prior, we had adopted a resolution some months ago now that was a very simple statement of our support for both conservation efforts and the bypass proceeding. I think Midway maybe has some more specific ideas of what they'd like to see. And it doesn't surprise me that they have some concerns. They've raised some concerns from the very beginning of the EIS in that an EIS, as defined by federal code, sets out a specific purpose and need. And the purpose and need for the bypass is to help preserve the historic Main Street in Heber City while addressing transportation needs in the Heber Valley through, I believe it's 2040. Midway has wanted portions of their traffic to be included in that purpose and need statement. And while it wasn't in the original need, I think that there are things that the bypass could be doing. Some of the alternatives might have a positive impact on what ultimately may be traffic through Midway City.
So Midway's come up with a new idea, building a no-access highway that would parallel US 40 and is located as close to 40 as possible, basically running the length of the highway and connecting there at the intersection with River Road. Basically what the Legacy Highway does for Interstate 15 through Davis County. Have you all discussed that?
To my knowledge, the county council has not discussed in any detail, that specific alternative. I think we've been pretty clear in expressing our desire to minimize the impacts on the north fields, but ultimately it's UDOT are the ones that will do any kind of technical evaluation. And again, that's the intent of the EIS, is how do they meet the purpose and need? How do they do it in a way that is most objective and accounts for all of the data, all of the pieces of information that they need to consider? So I think we would generally be supportive of things that try to mitigate that impact, but ultimately it's not up to the county to decide what is the best alternative. Really, we're just hoping to end up minimizing any of those negative impacts and while maximizing the positive ones.
Yeah, but Midway's idea, as they suggested in their letter, is not even an alternative at this point. So is it too late in the process to change things up?
You know, I don't know specifically if UDOT is considering revising any of the alternatives. We have had some conversations with them related to a project that the county is working on adjacent to the bypass, and they've indicated that they were not concerned about our project because they, at least in this area, didn't think that there were going to be any major changes to it. So I think it's possible they may consider changes. I think it's likely that they will evaluate the ones that they've already publicly revealed.
Yeah, so Midway's idea, I mean, you think that's too impactful on the North Fields?
I mean, it certainly has some advantages over some of the northern routes in that if it doesn't bisect the north fields, it preserves a more contiguous agricultural space. But whether or not it's viable from a traffic standpoint, or there are other impacts like how UDOT has tried to align some of those alternatives to minimize impacts to wetlands. And I don't know what the wetland impacts would be on that further east side. Maybe they're better, maybe they're worse. Again, those all come down to what that technical analysis is from the EIS process.
All right. I also wanted to ask you about any thoughts about Wasatch County implementing e-bike rules. Certainly with that crash in Midway last week, people are talking a lot about it. As I understand, Wasatch County does not have any formal rules for e-bikes.
That's true. And we have not discussed, I think almost on any level, whether or not we would get involved in e-bike regulation. It can be a little bit of a tricky issue, both from like what standards you want to adopt and also what those enforcement mechanisms look like. I mean, it's possible that a council members may be interested just because of kind of, like you said, the more recent issues that we've dealt with. But thus far, we've tried to just keep a hands-off approach for the time being.
All right. Anything going on with the Heber Valley 9/11 Day of Service that you wanted to mention?
You know, there are a lot of opportunities around the Heber Valley. I think we are generally supportive of making sure that people take an opportunity to help their neighbors and use this as a great community building opportunity.
All right, Dustin, anything else you wanted to mention?
Not this morning.
All right, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Dustin Graybow is Wasatch County Manager. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:28. KPCW News Time now, 8:30. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, Holy Cross Ministry annual Autumn Harvest Benefit is happening September 19th at Park City St. Mary's Parish Hall and Patio. It'll feature a keynote address from Sister Norma Pimentel, who has been dubbed as the Pope's favorite nun. In the studio with details about the fundraiser, I have the Executive Director of Holy Cross Ministries, Emmy Gardner. We're also joined by phone by Sister Pimentel. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for joining us. Well, Emmy, we'll start with you. As I mentioned, we've got September 19th as the annual Harvest Fall Benefit. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah, so the Autumn Harvest Benefit is something we've been doing for more than 10 years now, primarily up here in Park City, and only in the last couple of years did we bring it back down to Salt Lake post-pandemic. And so when St. Mary's offered us the space, we gladly took it and decided it would be great to come back up here. I mean, a couple years ago we had it, historically we've had it like at High West, and then and then 2 years ago, we had it at the DeJoria Center. And then just, post-pandemic with the just increasing cost piece, it just became unsustainable because so much of the money that we try to raise from the Autumn Harvest Benefit goes to direct service, right, for our program. So as much as we can, lower overhead costs, the better we are with obviously putting all that money to good in our various service programs.
Okay. Hey, sister, are you here with us?
Yes, I'm on the call on my phone from the office, and it went silent, so I'm calling you now from my cell phone.
Oh, okay, well, good. So, thank you for joining us.
Go ahead and hang up the other one, right?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Okay, still got you. Great. I wanted to start with you, sister, and just maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and some of the work that you have done that you have found meaningful in your life.
Thank you. Well, thank you for the invitation to be able to be here with you. It's amazing that I have a chance to explain and all the things that happen here at the border with Texas and Mexico, and the great number of people that families, children that come to our border looking for protection and safety. These are innocent, vulnerable families that are fleeing circumstances that are very difficult in their homes and traveled great lengths through encountering hardships along the way and people taking advantage of them. And they arrived to our border in a situation where the community here, our local families and people were able to see the terrible conditions they're in, and they need help, they need care, they need a heart that welcomes them and says, how can I help you? Let me offer you food and water and just restore their dignity. And that's what we have focused here at the border, local families who believe that God, who is within us, who loves us, is asking us to reach out and help these families that are in our community, needing help and needing a caring heart. And so we have done this for the past 10 years, and this is what we do as a way to live out our faith and show that it is humans sharing the goodness of us into other humans.
All right, so you're based on the ground there in McAllen, Texas, working where?
Working in the Diocese of Brownsville, the Catholic Church. We have in McAllen, we have a respite center, a center where the Border Patrol brings us the families that they apprehend and process and then give permission to continue their legal proceedings to another part in the United States, and they drop them off with us so that we can make sure they're not in the streets homeless and exposed to dangers. We guide them to make sure their families contact them and they can move on to their final destination, wherever they're going to see if they can have asylum in this country.
Yeah, can you give us an idea? I mean, what kind of numbers are you dealing with?
Well, since we started, there were high numbers as far as like 200 and immigrants, and those numbers went up as we proceeded throughout the years, and then they went back down. And the most we've ever had was in 2019. But today, numbers are extremely very low. If we had 25 families to maybe is the most we've seen all this year. You know, it's mostly because families that enter the United States are being sent back home, you know, and so this administration has really focused on the enforcement of the border and returning people back to their home countries. And so the numbers that we see of families arriving to our center are not that high anymore.
All right. Well, as I mentioned in the introduction, you will be giving a keynote address at the Autumn Harvest Benefit on September 19th here in Park City. Can you give us a sneak peek of what you plan to talk to?
What I would like to talk about is the responsibility we all have as Catholics, Christians, people of good faith, that recognize that God is with us, that God blesses us and fills our heart with his love. And we are called to share that love with every other person that we encounter. And immigrants are people that are here in our communities and that need us to share that God's love to them. And so I believe that we have a responsibility to live out our faith, and with especially the most vulnerable in our communities. And so how can that be explained and lived out? And so that is what I want to be able to talk about, you know, so that we can be able to do as our Holy Father calls us to make sure that in our time today, immigrants are a very vulnerable community that are need our love and protection. And so my talk will be about that, about what does that mean and how can I be true to that love that God gives me as a person, as a child of God, and how can I share that love with others.
Okay. Emmy, how did you decide to bring Sister Norma in to speak at Autumn Harvest?
Well, you know, we typically haven't had a keynote speaker, but again, given that it's an election year and given kind of all the false narrative around the immigration population and that is so squarely the population that we support in this community, you know, there's a school across the street from St. Mary's College, which is the sponsored ministry of the Sisters of the Holy Cross. It's called Notre Dame, and Notre Dame actually awarded Sister Norma one of the highest medals that they can for her humanitarian service. And so we just thought, how better than to have someone who is there at the border seeing what is happening, because then we are the recipients of those who have made Utah their final destination, right? And in Utah, while we are not a sanctuary state, we are very well known in the immigrant population to be a very welcoming state. Again, just because of Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the international focus. And so we are seeing a really large in-migration of immigrants coming to Utah, and a large in-migration up here in the Summit and Wasatch, in the Wasatch back as well, again, for work opportunity.
Yeah. Sister, I read somewhere that people say you are the Pope's favorite nun. Can you tell us the story behind that?
Of course, you know, the reason why that I got that title is because in 2015, Pope Francis had a satellite connection with us here at the border, and recognizing the extraordinary work that we were doing here in taking care of immigrant families and children, and he wanted to recognize that work that I was doing, and he asked to talk to me. And so when he did, you know, one of the things that he said, you know, which at the moment I couldn't believe that he was actually singling me out and asking me to come forward so that he could see me and talk to me. And he said, I'm going to say something that I know it's probably not right, or we never heard a Holy Father ever say this, but I want to say that I love you very much, you know. And so that the media right away said from that he's the Pope's favorite nun, you know, because he just said he loves her very much, you know. So I think he was referring to everybody who does the God's work, you know, and that treats others with respect and love and care, you know. And so he singled me out to show me that he believed that it was exactly what we must all do. And so I share that love that he shared with me with everyone else, you know.
All right. Emmy, Can you give us the particulars of the event? I mentioned it's September 19th there at the St. Mary's Parish Hall.
Right, right. So right off of 224 and White Pine Canyon Road, right? Tickets are $225 a piece. I know that sounds a little pricey, but I think we're in the low end up here in the fundraising season up here in Park City. So hoping people can join us. And super easy to get the tickets online. All you have to do is type in autumnharvest.party. So autumnharvest, all one word, .party, and that'll take you right to our website.
Okay. And what's going to happen there? You'll have dinner?
Yes, we have wonderful, you know, thanks for asking that too, because again, given the richness of our immigrant story and the clients that we serve, we're doing very much farm to table. And, you know, we know that it does take a lot of our local immigrant support to bring those foods to us. And so we will be kind of definitely having a wonderful harvest, right, in terms of fresh fruits, veggies, that kind of thing for our meal. Sister Norma will have a silent auction, we'll have live auction items, opportunity to just kind of mingle, learn from. Many of our staff will be there too. We really like integrating our staff with the donors so that they can really hear firsthand what the work is like, and feel that that's just kind of a powerful story for our staff to share what it's like for them to be doing, as Sister Norma said. I mean, we really just firmly believe in being good humans to fellow humans, and especially this year, given the election and all that, we really want to amplify what incredible people our immigrant community is and how they really are enriching us, not just in terms of workforce, but the diversity, the culture, all of those things that if we can celebrate that, we truly are doing, as Sister Norma said, in really just, you know, being Christ-like to all humanity, and that's what we want to be.
So, Sister Norma, Emmy just mentioned some of your work, I think, being part of the silent auction. My understanding is that on top of the duties that you have in the Rio Grande Valley, you also paint. So are you going to be bringing some of your art?
I am. So there is a painting that will be auctioned out. And so, yes, I believe that it's one of the things that I've done, and I love to paint since I can remember as I was a little girl. And so I paint the families that arrive to our center, especially the moms that carry their babies wrapped in serape all around their, in their bag. And so I captured one of those images of a child looking at me when they were coming in, and I painted that. And so I believe that's one of the paintings that will be auctioned out.
Okay. Emmy, how much are you hoping to raise here?
You know, usually for us, donations for this, I mean, we usually are hoping, you know, to bring in well over 100,000, 120, 125. We realize it's been, again, people are giving to political campaigns this year, and so we've really seen our contributions down. So, yeah, definite plea to the community if you can come. And if you can't, I mean, we'll have silent auction items online, so you'll be able to go to our website and find that if you're not able to be there, but to maybe bid on things. But it really has been a tough, tight year, I think, just because of the election as well. And so we're really looking, as we, you know, again, we max out our grants, but we need our contributions and donations as well to really help us continue to expand the services, you know, that our community needs.
Yeah, and what do you do with the funds that you raise?
So they all go to a direct service for our programs. We have three main pillars, right? Health, education, and justice. The early childhood education program is here. But what we're really seeing is, again, given the influx of new arrivals, a really big push for our legal department to expand beyond our U visa, which is typically the visa status for folks that are victims of a crime, a lot of our survivors of DV and sexual assault, to now really seeing folks, as Sister Norma mentioned, coming in pleading asylum. And the challenge is that many of these folks don't have sponsors, whether it's a family member or a church or whoever, and so they don't have the funding, and we need to at least work with them to help them get employment authorization so that they can then work, so that they can kind of work toward their legal status. And so really kind of directing the funds for that are huge, as well as our other wraparound service that truly supports the new arrivals is all of our health. So both our mental health services, as well as our community health workers who are helping folks navigate, you know, and get the medical help and support that they need.
Yeah. So do you see that legal challenge as your biggest need at this point?
Biggest right now, just in terms of the in-migration, right, of new arrivals, for sure.
Okay. Anything else you want to let people know about the fundraiser?
It will be a wild time, and you'd be fool not to come. So please, come join us. It would be wonderful.
Okay. Emmy Gardner, Sister Norma Pimentel, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:46. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Joined now on the phone with an update from Utah Open Lands, I have the Executive Director, Wendy Fisher. Good morning, Wendy.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's see, let's start off with your fundraiser, the Portraits of Preservation, happening this week, Thursday, at the River Bottoms Ranch in Midway. Do you still have tickets available?
We have a few. I think we're down to like 10, to be honest with you.
Okay.
So we have a few available.
Okay, well, that's good news. How would people access those?
They can just go to our website, Utah Open Lands, and the Portraits of Preservation will pop up, and they can just click there. And if they can't come, they can also make a donation to the work that we're doing.
Okay. Tell us what's going to happen there at the fundraiser.
Well, I think one of the things that's going to be really exciting for folks is one of the reasons that we've chosen River Bottoms Ranch is it's right there in the heart of one of our campaigns right now, which is the protection of the North Fields in the Midway area. And we're really, really grateful to Jared and Janica that we have the ability to be at that facility because it really shows the beauty of the North Fields. In fact, just beyond the view from the barn is one of the projects we're working to protect that is right adjacent to not only the Kohler Dairy that we protected several years ago, but also the Provo River Restoration Project. So it just expands that amount of open space. So be able to let the audience know not only how far we've come in our first phase of the North Field Protection Initiative, but also the fact that we have $17 million in funding that we have applied for, we're hoping to get for the second phase of the North Fields. And then we'll also be announcing one of the projects in the North Fields that we finally funded. So it should be a night of exciting announcements and really just a great time to get together with all of the supporters of Utah Open Lands, the folks that really care about this land protection work, that understand the importance of it, and, you know, to celebrate the successes.
Yeah, so what have you raised then for that kind of that first phase of it?
Well, so that first phase, we've raised around $10 million. And that's through a combination of different federal grants, and also it's a combination that and landowner contributions, as well as some private foundations. And then last year, we had some great donations to our North Fields Protection Initiative. But the fundraiser isn't just about that. It really is about all of the work that Utah Open Lands is doing, because there's a lot of conservation that is in need right now as we battle everything from climate change to protecting the character of our community.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in just a second, but this $17 million, this is what you have, what, coming from the federal government, or this is what you have from landowners hoping to get conservation easements on their property?
No, so the $17 million is actually a new application that we've submitted that we're hoping to get. We've already raised that $10 million, but it's a new application for additional projects in the North Fields. We have about 300 acres from various different landowners in that North Fields, Heber Valley area that are interested in land protection. And so that's why we've written this grant, and we're hoping to find out in October.
Okay, so the grant then would need to be matched with local dollars. Is that how it works?
Yes, local dollars, which, as you mentioned, Leslie, can include landowner contributions. And it's just amazing to me to see the landowners who really want to protect their land. It is about the fact that they love their land, that a lot of them, you know, the funding actually goes so that they can sustain owning that land and continuing the heritage and the legacy that's been there for generations.
Yeah. So when you do get a conservation easement, a protection on this property there in the North Fields, what it does is that it prevents development from happening. I mean, and we think about residential development. Does it also protect a state highway from coming through?
No, it's not safe from condemnation. Conservation easements are not safe from condemnation. And so that is something that, you know, Utah Open Lands does defend these conservation easements. But that's definitely something that we look at. I think one of the threats that we have is poor planning. Poor planning is something that threatens all of our community character, but it also threatens really some of the values that we can really sustain in terms of restoration in some of these areas, water quality, airshed quality. That's, I think, the thing that's toughest about the work that we're doing is that if we really think about where the growth is going to occur and how we can grow smart, how we can grow efficiently, thinking about really 10, 15, 20 years into the future, how are things going to change even in the way that we get from place to place? If we don't do that good planning, then yeah, those are continuing threats. But no, it is not safe from condemnation.
Yeah, and as you know, UDOT is certainly considering different alternatives and the environmental impacts for that bypass road. Are we talking about perhaps condemning some of the property that has been protected here if one of those alternatives were to go through?
At this point, we don't see that as being a threat. I think the biggest threat is that there are two alternatives that the UDOT has been considering, and those would go through the North Fields. And that in and of itself, I think it would be a travesty for that area. If you look at inversion issues, if you look at water quality issues, but, you know, certainly that's not our intent.
Okay. Also wanted to give you an opportunity to tell us about some of the other projects that you are working on. Some of these have to do with the greater shoreline of the Great Salt Lake. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think that a lot of people recognize the value of the Great Salt Lake. We recognize it in terms of the importance of getting it up to that 4,200-foot level so that it really can sustain an amazing ecological system. I don't know if your listeners know, but the Great Salt Lake is also, you know, the flyway for one-third of the North American bird species. So you have everything from pelicans, which have come back after 81 years to net, and then also black-necked stilts, white-faced ibis, just an amazing ecology there. And so Utah Open Lands is working on three projects right now, some which include some springs and wetlands that obviously are right there along the shoreline of the Great Salt Lake. So we're excited to be working on those. We hope to be able to announce that we're successful in the coming, you know, months to a year.
Yeah, and you're also hoping to protect some sage grouse areas near Bear Lake?
Yeah, one of the amazing things that I think people, if they've ever been out to witness a sage grouse dance, as I like to call it, there's a lek that the sage grouse dance on. And the way I describe a lek is it really is essentially the dance floor. If the sage grouse don't dance, then we don't end up having more sage grouse, if people can understand that. And so basically Utah Open Lands has been working with two different landowning families who own some significant properties around Bear Lake. And one of these projects actually contains a whole sage grouse lek, so they contain the actual dance floor. The other property has habitat for sage grouse because sage grouse are not a migrating species. But I think the other thing that we're struggling with here in the state of Utah that we're seeing in so many of our amazing lakes is the toxic algae bloom. And I think a lot of people have started to look at the Bear Lake area, see that Caribbean blue that is such a signature value of that area, and some of the development and some of the pollution that's starting to enter that lake is actually starting to threaten that signature Caribbean blue. So part of what we're doing is not just protecting these sage grouse habitats, but also one of the projects includes 200 acres right along the shoreline of Bear Lake. And that particular property, which is a total of about 600 acres, we have fully funded. In the coming months, we'll be able to announce that final protection.
Okay. You're also going to be participating with Preserve Midway for the annual Volksmark. Tell us about this.
So, as many of your listeners know, Preserve Midway and also the Friends of the Heber Valley are doing great work to raise awareness, to raise funds, and to work towards the protection of some of those vital open spaces that contribute to the community character in the Midway area. And so Preserve Midway has this great event called Volks March. This year, we're happy to be a partial sponsor in that. It's a great time to get a bunch of folks, a bunch of nonprofits that are out there supporting the community. And it's just basically a walk. And hopefully you'll be able to have some folks on from Preserve Midway to talk about it. It happens September 14th. And this year it's going to be on a property that will eventually have a conservation easement on it. And the walk is going to go along that amazing Snake Creek area.
Okay. People just show up or do they need to register? I mean, is it a free?
I believe it's free, although I think I'm not sure where Preserve Midway is at with that, but I think it is. I believe Volks March refers to the People's March. And so I think it is. It's just to get everybody together. I know that Dr. Steve Stevens usually leads off the march with his amazing Friesian. So that's a sight to see, those beautiful horses. He starts off the march.
Okay. And of course, the opening of the Bonanza Loop Trail last week, you were there for that?
I was. And I think... I got to say, Leslie, you know, one of the things that's always a challenge when we look at the protection of these properties and the conservation values is that sometimes conservation values can come into conflict. Recreation and wildlife, for example, is one of the things that often comes to mind. And so we've really enjoyed the discussions. Sometimes it's been a little bit back and forth and it hasn't been easy, but we've enjoyed the discussions with neighbors, with Park City Municipal, and also with our good partners, the Mountain Trails Foundation, really about crafting a multi-use trail that allows people to enjoy Bonanza Flat, but that also was mindful of the environment. As I think you know, a lot of Bonanza Flat has to have some restoration take place because of some of the social trails that were there. One of the big achievements was when we were able to reroute the Bloods Lake Trail and do some restoration. I'm happy to report that the siltation and erosion that was coming from the original trail, we've really dissipated that almost to the fact that there's really none of that erosion coming in. But there are other places. And so as we looked at where we would do the multi-use trail, which was part of the conceptual trail plan back in 2020, we knew that we had to really be sensitive to the fact that it was going to cross into different regions on Bonanza Flat. And so there are a couple of things that we were really looking at. One was how it would work into the greater ecosystem. But then also there are some restrictions on that trail. One of those restrictions is that because of calving and fawning season, people will not be able to enjoy the trail until after July 1st. And then the trail does close October 1st, and that's for other wildlife reasons. And then there's also a limitation on dogs. You cannot bring dogs on the multi-use trail. I think there are two different directional trails on it, one for hiking and one for mountain biking, that we hope will also elevate the recreational experience. But at the end of the day, I think we really took into account some of the thoughts and considerations that people had, you know, in terms of where they wanted to see that trail. And I think we really ended up with something that is delightful, that the community can enjoy, that really strikes a balance on the property. We're going to be doing more restoration. In fact, we have a couple of restoration events coming up on Bonanza in October. Hope to let you guys know more about that. But really kudos to people coming together, people being able to lay aside their disagreements and talk about how we could make this work. And, you know, real kudos to Mountain Trails Foundation. They do great work. Got to give a shout out to Rick and all of his good work. And then obviously the landowner and great partner, Park City Municipal.
Okay, I got to leave it there. Wendy, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
Wendy Fisher with Utah Open Lands.